10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more?
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout the year, we've been featuring a series we call 11 for 11, conversations with innovative thinkers who challenge and provoke new ways of approaching the biggest issues of our time. Dr. Raymond Tallis is a former clinical neuroscientist turned author. His book, Aping Mankind, targets what he calls neurotrash, the explosion of pseudoscience that reduces human behavior from believing in God to falling in love to pure physical impulses in the brain. In other words, exactly the kind of breakthroughs word of mouth frequently reports on. Now, we asked Jeff whether the emergence of reliable brain scan technology might rival DNA evidence in future trials. Here's what he said.
DNA is different. DNA isn't telling you what somebody thinks.
Does the brain scan of a psychotic person look different than that of someone who has a strong moral compass?
Take the psychopathy one.
A long-held understanding of how our brains actually store and then access memory. Tell us about direct access.
So the old model of memory was that the brain is a bit like a
hard drive. Example to live by Professor Beatrice Luna. She teaches psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh and is a leader in the growing field of developmental neuroscience. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link. Well, Ray Tallis is taking aim at what he calls a kind of neuromania, this assertion and a belief that biological destiny, backed up by brain science, is now guiding several different aspects of our life, not only in the sciences, but daily life and social policy. And as you say, Ray Tallis, in the humanities, what's your concern there?
I'm rather amazed that the humanities, in a sense, have collaborated with pseudosciences. And there are many humanities now that embrace the application of neuroscience to human life in a way that really seems to undermine their own ethos. Neuroaesthetics says that if you want to understand art, you should look what happens to the brain of people looking at bits of art. Neurolaw says if you want to make appropriate judgments in the court, then you should do brain scans on people who are accused of crimes. Neuroeconomics says if you want to understand why we make such unwise decisions, then we should look at the balance between the frontal lobe, which is prudent and tells us wait for it, and the amygdaloid body says I want it now, and so on and so forth. And it's rather surprising in a sense that the humanities have embraced neuroscience in this way. One of the founding concepts of the humanities was that individuals have a dignity, that they are conscious agents, not automatons in the grip of biological or indeed physical processes.
But don't these things, you know, musicology, maybe theology, have some sort of grounding in biology?
I don't think so. And I always find the neurological investigation of music extraordinarily barren. In fact, most research into what the music does to the brain fails to differentiate not only between J.S. Bach, for example, and Amy Winehouse. They both basically stimulate the dopaminergic pathways, apparently. But it fails to distinguish between the response to drugs or even sexual stimulus. And it seems to me that a science that cannot differentiate between hearing an organ played and having one's organs played with can't tell you much about either.
Doesn't the idea of being biologically bound offer some hope for people, for instance, who suffer from mental illnesses, that they know that it is not a spiritual or moral failing on their part, but there is something with their brain that can be healed?
I think that's a really good point. It seems to me that when understanding mental illness, we have to see that it's got two facets. Clearly, there are differences in the brain in people who have schizophrenia. But that's not the end of the story. The person with schizophrenia very poignantly tries to make sense of what their brain is telling them. So the symptoms of schizophrenia are very personal. So to reduce schizophrenia to dysfunction of the brain doesn't do justice, if you like, to the heroism of a person with schizophrenia who is trying to make sense of the world despite what's happening. But the abnormality in the brain certainly is the underlying problem with schizophrenia. So you're quite right, the biological approach to mental disease is actually quite optimistic, so long as we don't reduce mental disease simply to its biological basis. And that's true on a broader front. We clearly have biological roots, we human beings. Most of the functions that I perform from day to day, whether it's, you know, eating or defecating or breathing and so on, clearly are biological. But that's not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. Biological dysfunction of the brain is the beginning of the story. And when one respects the individual who suffers from schizophrenia, it's acknowledging that they clearly have this problem, which has a biological origin, but they themselves heroically are trying to make sense of it.
I read a review of this book in The Guardian that said you are attempting to rescue atheism from the atheists. And I wonder, is there something inherently religious or even spiritual in your argument that there is something more than just biology that drives us?
I've been accused of lots of things. I've been accused of having a religious agenda, which I don't. I've been accused of being a creationist, which I'm most certainly not. I sign up to Darwinism. And I've been accused of being a dualist, so that I believe that we are kind of ghosts in the machine of the body, and I don't believe in that at all. My feeling is I'm just inviting people to look at what's in front of their nose, which is the most difficult thing, just to see how different we are from animals, and indeed to celebrate that, and also to acknowledge that our future is not something that can be explained by a biological script. The future lies in our own hands to shape. Humankind has been something that has shaped its own destiny rather than being shaped, as it were, by the biological prescription. And it's just saying, remember you have freedom. Remember that collectively and individually we make choices. Don't pretend for a moment that we are fated by our Darwinian heritage. There is evidence that we've actually broken away from biology. Of course, as a doctor, I know we are still organisms. You know, every time I eat a meal, I know that I'm an organism that requires nutrition. There's more to it than just nutrition. Meals are highly symbolic. The food I eat has been brought together from all the four corners of the earth and so on and so forth. So I'm just reminding people about the extraordinary and miraculous truths of humanity.
Is biologism the enemy of hope, to quote the title of your former book?
I think it is, if you think we are fated to enact a biological script. And some writers have made that very clear. I mean, there's a very eloquent political philosopher, John Gray, who said that we delude ourselves when we think we are different from animals. We delude ourselves when we think we can control our fate in the way that animals never do. In fact, if anything, we're not any animals, but we're terrible animals. And I think there is a profound pessimism built into the biological reduction of human beings. Some biologists would deny that. The brilliant primatologist Franz de Waal says we've got biological reasons for being cheerful about ourselves. You know, some chimps are jolly nice. But actually, if you look at the animal kingdom overall, most animals are jolly rotten to each other. They don't seem to fret over each other's fate. If you're trying to find sources of good cheer in the claim that we are to be understood biologically, you've got to be terribly pick and mix as to which beasts you choose to think we've inherited our propensities from. We take the biological givens and run with them to places that are not envisaged in biology at all.
Simon Shorvin of the UCL Institute of Neurology writes that all neuroscientists should read this book. Do you think you've changed any minds?
I haven't changed probably any current minds that are in the ascendant, but I'm vain enough to think that I might change the minds of those who are emerging in future. I've always thought my lottery ticket was in the 22nd century.
Dr. Tallis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Raymond Tallis, former doctor and professor, now full-time writer. His works include The Kingdom of Infinite Space, Enemies of Hope, and most recently, Aping Mankind, which we talked about today. To find more on the book and Dr. Tallis, and to hear more of our 11 for 11 series of conversations, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Amid news of serious clashes between Occupy Wall Street protesters and police and Homeland Security agents on Thursday, this week a lesser conflict emerged from New York City. It's what you could call the revenge of the interns. The first lawsuit to challenge the practice of unpaid internships in more than 50 years comes from two interns who worked on the set of Black Swan. They're suing the film's production company for violating state and federal laws.
The plaintiffs claimed that Fox used more than 100 unpaid interns for performing tasks from ensuring the coffee pot was full to taking lunch orders from the crew to picking up trash. Not exactly the learning experience they were promised. The New York Times reports that former Black Swan intern Alex Footman, a 2009 film studies graduate from Wesleyan, said that the only thing he learned from his unpaid gig was to be more picky in choosing employment opportunities. Well, we can say with absolute certainty that interning at Word of Mouth offers a much more meaningful experience. If you'd like to volunteer or intern with us, we encourage you to fill out an application at the About page at nhpr.org. Around here, interns are an invaluable part of turning ideas into radio. No dry cleaning pickups, no orders for egg white omelets, and they are only asked politely to fetch coffee if they're already getting a cup for themselves. I'm Virginia Prescott. From all of us here at Word of Mouth, we are grateful for the time you spent with us today. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back next Saturday with more new ideas on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Virginia Prescott,
and Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
Courtney Kenya.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show,
to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment,
or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Word of Mouth.
We should do like a thing where we go,
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Whoa, totally out of breath there. I'm going to try that again.